Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I say I listen to all voices, but mine's the final decision. And I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider.
Yes, he is. It is the home stretch of 30 issues in 30 days. We are up to issue 27, Presidential Leadership and Management Styles. We just played President Bush in his famous I'm the Decider statement defending Secretary Rumsfeld. And we all know presidents not only have to have ideas and policies, they have to run the show and get people to go along with their ideas. So today we take a look at what kind of leader and what kind of manager the next president might be. And we'll start with a look back at how other presidents have run the ship of state. Joining me for this is Princeton historian Julian Zelizer. Welcome back to the show, Professor Zelizer. Always good to have you.
Great to be here with you.
George W. Bush is the first president to have an MBA. Did you know that?
I did not know that offhand.
How did his corporate experience transfer to the White House?
Well, we're not sure at this time. I mean, we know he says he's the decider, but there's this other image of him as being run by the people around him rather than actually making the decision. So there's the image of Vice President Cheney standing on the side, kind of, you know, really commanding the president to do what he wants rather than vice versa. So we don't know yet. We're going to have to see the record of which of those images is correct.
Do you think he really thinks he was the decider and Cheney really thinks he was the decider?
That could be, and we've had that before. I mean, there's often times when members of the cabinet or a vice president, you know, thinks they're calling the shots, but in fact the president was, you know, firmly in command of what was going to happen. That's often an effective style of presidential leadership. You make everyone think as if they're running the show, but in fact you're the one making the decisions.
When did we start to look at how presidents manage and lead? I remember a big study of JFK's decision-making or reading about it, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Is it a modern phenomenon, this study, or did someone study John Quincy Adams' management style?
Well, now we have studies of many of the presidents, but it really took off studying JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis. That became the quintessential moment of presidential leadership many decades ago now. There was a study written kind of using that to show what a president should do in a time of crisis, to sit around when we are at the verge of war, to listen to competing sides, and then to make a decision on their own. It turns out this wasn't exactly the case, but that moment and that kind of president, I think, really changed the way we study leadership.
What kind of manager was John F. Kennedy?
Well, John F. Kennedy was not as cool and deliberate as we thought, but in general, some of that image was correct. You know, he was a president who liked to hear different positions. He liked to hear both sides of the argument. He'd like to have someone advocating war and peace, you know, stimulating the economy and doing nothing. And he was very smart and able to process information after hearing those different points of view. So that's the kind of decision-making we've seen when we study, you know, the tapes and the transcripts of what he was doing behind the scenes.
A big recent history divide in management styles seems to be between Carter and Reagan, and they illustrate the danger of getting lost in details and on the other side maybe getting lost in the big picture.
Yeah, I think those are really the two models that presidents think about these days. Carter was very smart, and he had very good command of policy detail. The problem was he got so consumed with the small parts and the details of something like energy policy that he had problems kind of selling the bigger political vision and building the political coalitions needed to sell his policies. Reagan was the opposite. He was a big picture guy. He was willing to let his advisors deal with the details and cabinet meetings. He often seemed like he wasn't even paying attention. You know, he was known for making jokes and telling stories when we were talking about Central America policy. But then he had the ability to really sell the idea to the public. So two different kinds of leadership styles that I think the next president will think about.
Do you think, though, the Iran-Contra affair was an example of Reagan getting lost in the big picture and missing some of the details?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, he knew more than we thought. So while he was focused on the big picture, he also was aware of some of the transactions that were taking place. You know, we never fully found out how much he knew. You know, he wasn't in trouble at the end of the day. But that was an argument made in the 1980s. You know, it was a less hostile vision of what had happened, that this was a guy who was kind of so removed from the days, day in and day out of American policymaking, that bad things could happen under his command.
But we still don't know what Reagan really knew and when he knew it.
We don't, but we do know he knew more than it appeared at the time, which is often the case. You know, while he in the meetings allowed advisors to make arguments and was more focused on the big picture, he was also a very intelligent, shrewd policymaker who for decades had been working on many of these ideas. So probably it's somewhere in between.
Anyone else among the presidents fall into either of those two camps, the details versus the big picture?
Sure. I mean, Bill Clinton was a little of both. He was notoriously chaotic at some moments of his presidency, just allowing everyone to tell him different positions and then making a decision. But in general, he had the two characteristics. He was really good at understanding the nuances of something like Medicare hospital finance. But at the same time, as his presidency progressed, he became better and better at selling a bigger picture of what he wanted to do in terms of globalization. Or free trade or some of those issues. So he actually combined both. Lyndon Johnson was a very different style. He had a decent command of the details, but he was very good at selling ideas, not in public. He wasn't a great speechmaker, but on the phone, he was absolutely terrific at handling legislators and policymakers, and he had a very different style in that respect.
Funny that you should lead me right into our clip, as if you knew it was coming, of LBJ, I think from 1963, but I don't have the exact date. Let's see. This is a phone call he made to Senator William Fulbright, and it shows the way he worked with leaders of Congress.
I want to read this. Yes?
Senator Fulbright on 2190.
Bill?
Yes?
I was talking to Dick earlier today, and I expressed the hope that he would invite you and Hickenlooper to sit in with him on his CIA committee for these briefings. He said he'd be glad to do it, that he didn't want to add to it, he wouldn't let a good many members of his own committee sit in on him because of obvious reasons. But he'd take you too. Now, I guess he's going to come along with it, and I just hope that you agree to get on it and serve on it, and because I think it's very important that you know all they tell them, and then I want to be talking to you from time to time and get your judgments on it.
Sure, I'll be glad to.
Well, now you just wait till he invites you, because I told him to extend the invitation, because it'd be better for him to do it than me to be saying who served on his committee.
Ever hear that clip before?
I haven't heard that particular one, no.
What do you take from it?
Well, that's classic Johnson. On the one hand, he's basically telling Fulbright to serve on the committee when asked, although he's still asking him. And on the other hand, we think it's probably Richard Russell, but you know, he's saying wait until he actually extends the invitation, and part of that is playing to whoever Dick is at the time. And so he has a really great sense of playing to different people's egos and interests. And at the one hand, he kind of removes himself from telling people what to do, but it's very clear when the president's calling you on the phone, he's telling you what to do. So it's classic Johnson. If you hear the tapes, that was his management style. Pick up the phone, talk to everyone, every position, and try to find ways to play to their ego but get what he wanted.
Is there a partisan divide when it comes to management styles? There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that suggested that Republicans tend to go with their guts while Democrats are more deliberative. Is that what history shows?
I don't know. I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, that would be the kind of Carter versus Reagan.
Yeah.
But, you know, Johnson really led with his gut. I mean, he wasn't a policy wonk. He really kind of had his instincts about what politics would allow and what it wouldn't allow. FDR was famous, you know, for selling a kind of vision of confidence and trust in the American government and the economy. So, and JFK too. I mean, his speech making was famous for kind of setting out a vision of what needed to happen in this country. So we've had presidents who've done both. I think it's not always the case.
By the way, thinking about Johnson and Fulbright, Didn't Johnson once refer to Fulbright as half bright?
Yes.
As he started hearings against the Vietnam War?
Yes, he loved, that was one of the insults that he did, the one I could probably say on the radio, but he really detested Fulbright. But what's amazing is if you hear the phone calls with him, you wouldn't know that, even as the hearings were going on. And that's why Johnson was very good at that kind of politicking.
Here's a clip of Richard Nixon from the interviews he did with David Frost.
Isn't there in that whole conversation
a paranoid attitude?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. And it gets back to the statement that I made, rather emotional statement, the day I left office. And I said, don't hate other people because hatred destroys yourself. Yeah, I want to say here that I have a temper. I control it publicly rather well. Sometimes privately I blow off some steam. But also, as I've indicated, and this is very hard for people to believe, but I think you can believe it after our session a few hours ago, my weaknesses is perhaps where personal factors are concerned.
Well, that kind of takes us more into the realm of psychology than management styles, but maybe we should look at inner demons in psychology for a moment. Are presidents able to keep the public and the private separate?
No, I mean, well, not with Nixon. He's a fascinating case study of a president who is extremely smart, who he actually had a kind of Clinton-esque command of policy, a very good political instinct, but his personality just destroyed him and his presidency. I mean, if you listen to his meetings with advisors, he does not sit well when people were criticizing him or trying to tell him what to do, and he could be incredibly aggressive, hostile, and downright angry with his opponents. He lacks some of what Johnson can do, meaning speaking to people of all sides and speaking with people who hated him. Nixon didn't have that in him, and in the end, I think it consumed his presidency.
Before we go on to two guests who are going to compare Obama's and McCain's leadership style specifically, and my guest is Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, 30 Issues in 30 Days, issue 27, Leadership and Management Styles, which president, I mean one president, do you think had the most effective leadership style? Is there one that stands out for you?
It's always FDR, and there I'm not speaking behind the scenes, but in public. He had a way to speak with Americans and offer them kind of assurances that things would be better in the worst economic crisis, and he just had the ability to convey that very simple message that makes him the most effective leader we've had. He took us through depression and war, and part of what he did was not the policies he passed, not the legislation he sent to Congress, but it was his leadership. It was his ability to convince a nation that things would become better under his leadership.
McCain has taken a beating over the way he has managed his campaign, particularly during the financial crisis. Can we draw any conclusions from the history of presidential campaigns to the way the president will manage the White House?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the campaign itself is something we overlook in judging presidents. And this year, because of the financial crisis, we got a great taste of how they run their campaigns and how they act in public. And I think both showed exactly the kind of leadership style we'll probably see. I mean, Barack Obama is much more restrained, cool, deliberative. He likes to work behind the scenes. And that's come out in the way he's run his campaign. And McCain has a very different style. He likes to kind of be in your face, make quick decisions, move from one idea to another very quickly, and inject himself in the center of the decisions. And my guess is both are very good predictors of the kind of leader you would have.
Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, so informative. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, issue 27, Obama and McCain's management and leadership styles. And we'll talk to two people who know them very well in a minute. Issues in 30 Days, issue 27, Management and Leadership Styles. Tomorrow, we'll kind of follow up on this general discussion of management and leadership styles to the question, who would be the better commander-in-chief, issue 28. And our final 30 issues wiki is up at WNYC.org, and you're invited to take part. It's for this Friday's final 30 issues program called Who'd Be the Best President for New York and New Jersey. If you haven't used a wiki before, it's not just a comments page. It's a way for you to collaborate with each other to help produce our series, suggest guests and questions and audio clips, even the words that come out of my mouth. Check out and contribute to the 30 Issues Wiki for Who'd Be the Best President for New York and New Jersey at WNYC.org/30issues. Well, we just heard some history about presidential management styles. Now we want to hear some specifics about the two current candidates. Is McCain decisive and bold, or impetuous and erratic? Is Obama disciplined and deliberative, or is he distant and opaque? And how does this demonstrate what kind of presidential administration each might have and how it might affect you? Joining me now, journalist David Mendel. He's the author of Obama, From Promise to Power, which was just issued in paperback last month. He also blogs for Chicago Magazine and teaches at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. David Mendel, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian.
And David Hawkins, the managing editor of Congressional Quarterly Weekly. He came to Washington when Senator McCain was elected to the Senate originally and has been following McCain closely since 1995. David Hawkins, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
And how much management experience do either one of these guys really have? David Mendel, Obama doesn't exactly have a long career even as a senator. He was a state legislator before that. But can you tell anything about management style from a legislator?
Well, that's right. He didn't have much management experience at all when he arrived in Washington. In fact, his close advisor, Valerie Jarrett, asked him, what is your management style? And he said, well, I don't really have one when he arrived in Washington. He had overseen an office of about 17 to 20 employees as a state senator. And, you know, while you do have to work on personalities and help people get along with each other, it was really only that and his term on the Harvard Law Review where we do have some examples of what his management style is. But, of course, now we have his presidential campaign also to review.
And we'll get those specific examples and your thoughts on them. But, David Hawkins, same question about McCain, just in terms of how much management experience. He's been in the Senate for a long time, but as we always hear, being a senator doesn't give you the executive management experience that, say, being a governor does.
That's exactly right. The only genuine management or executive experience John McCain's really ever had in his life was one of the most obscure periods of his life, which was after he was released from the POW camp in Hanoi and came back to the United States. While he was recuperating and trying to get his flying wings back again, he was put in charge of a somewhat obscure command at an Air Force base in Florida, where they fixed up aging planes to be used at the end of the Vietnam War. And that was really the only that he was a base commander for about 18 months, we sort of started seeing something of the Maverick McCain being driven to accomplish something while he was there. But that's his only genuine management experience.
What kind of a base commander was he?
Well, apparently he was he accomplished what he set out to do. This base was something of a backwater. The maintenance of these aging planes had really lagged. They were way behind on their targets. And he said, by the time I leave here in 15 months, which was the projected time of his command, you know, every one of these planes is going to be ready to fly. And apparently, sure enough, by hook or by crook, he got it done. And literally, the last plane was ready to fly a couple of days before his tour of duty as the commander was done. It was something of a Pyrrhic victory, because by the time this all happened, the war had essentially come to an end, and the planes were no longer really needed. But he was able to boast that he had, one way or another, by sort of alternately browbeating people and giving them lots of positive encouragement and being friends with people one day and their enemies the next, he got it all done, which has set the stage for how he's behaved in his political career.
What year was that, roughly?
This was in 19... Yeah, I knew you'd ask me this. This was 1976 and 1977. Mm-hmm. It was called Air Group 174 in Jacksonville, Florida.
And so going back in Barack Obama's life, David Mendel, you mentioned Harvard Law Review. He was the editor?
That's right. He was the president of the Harvard Law Review. And he surprised a lot of people with how he managed that review, particularly African Americans. They had hoped, since he was the first African American president of the review, that he would appoint a lot of African Americans to high editorial posts, as well as a lot of liberals. But he really did believe that he wanted to put out the best review possible, the one with the most diverse amount of opinions, most diverse number of opinions. And so he appointed a few conservatives to top editorial posts. And he wanted that array of opinions to, and he wanted to put out the best publication he could. So
let's take a specific example of leadership and management and decision making from the presidential campaign, how each candidate chose their vice president. David Hawkins, this has been so controversial for McCain. Sketch out your best understanding of the route that McCain took to settle upon Sarah Palin.
My best understanding is this, which is that John McCain knew all along that he wanted to make a vice presidential choice that would shake up the race, that would signal that he was decisive and thinking outside the box and distant from the Bush administration and willing to go in a decidedly bold direction, and that his initial choice, we think, was unequivocally Joe Lieberman, the Connecticut senator who was the Democratic nominee, the Democratic underscore nominee for vice president 8 years ago, one of John McCain's oldest friends in the Senate, one of his few genuinely close friends in the Senate, and that this was his choice to shake up the race, and that he was essentially talked out of it in some pretty heated conversations by his campaign advisors and by other Republicans who said, you'll blow up the Republican Party, you'll never get out of the convention. Joe Lieberman can't get the nomination at the convention. And that then he thought about a couple of other bold moves and was talked out of them as well. They tried to talk him into Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty, two very conservative choices, both conservative ideologically and conservative politically. He wouldn't hear of it, and that was when he made the somewhat impetuous decision to go with Sarah Palin, the governor who he had met really only once before he had his job interview with her, and really only that one time.
Well, impetuous maybe, but what I also take from that story is that McCain allowed himself to go against his own instincts and take the advice of his advisors and go with their judgment.
I think that's an excellent point, and I'm glad you picked up on that theme I was trying to weave in there, which is that McCain drives very hard to do things his way, but is not so obdurate and stubborn that he won't allow himself to be to have, you know, to sounds pejorative, but to have some sense talked into him. In this case, he was willing to listen to his advisors and have and sort of get talked off the political ledge.
And David Mendel, how did Obama settle upon Joe Biden? Do you know what that process was like?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, it was a very deliberative process. He took weeks and weeks, and it was almost, you know, no surprise at all when Biden was the final selection. I think the decision is reflective of, you know, the Harvard Law Review period, where he wanted someone who I think could help him govern. He didn't necessarily look at this so much as a political choice. It obviously had to be someone who would be palatable and be helpful to the section of voters who he was having problems with and still having problems with, which is blue-collar males. And Biden does help him to some degree in that, but the choice did not really give him a bump in the polls at all. It was a choice for the long haul. It was a choice to, I think, have someone there who was steady and someone who could help him be a good president. And I think if you look back at the Law Review, that's why he put some of the conservatives in place on the Law Review, because he wanted to put out a good publication. And it didn't really matter if some of his friends perhaps were alienated.
We can take some phone calls as we continue with 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 27, Obama's and McCain's Leadership Styles, for my guests David Mendel, author of Obama, From Promise to Power, and David Hawkins, the managing editor of Congressional Quarterly Weekly, who's been closely following John McCain for many years. on their management styles, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I want to play a clip of Senator Obama from the Rick Warren Saddleback Church Forum in the campaign. He was asked here about leadership and his leadership style. And here's about a minute of Obama's answer.
You know, there are so many people that are constantly helping to shape my views and my opinions. Mm-hmm. You mentioned one person I'd be listening to, and that's Michelle, my wife, who is not only wise, but she's honest. And one of the things you need, I think any leader needs, is somebody who can get up in your face and say, boy, you really screwed that one up. You really blew
that. Your wife's like that
too? She is. Yeah, so that's very helpful. What I found is very helpful to me is to have a table where a lot of different points of view are represented and where I can sit and poke and prod and ask them questions. So that I'm not, so that any blind spots I have or predispositions that I have, that my assumptions are challenged. And I think that that's extraordinarily important.
Okay.
So David Mendel, what's interesting there to me, and I wonder how much you think real life actions on the part of Obama support the philosophy that he was articulating there, that any blind spots I have or predispositions I have, that to see that my assumptions are challenged, to have different points of view represented around a table. That's one kind of leadership. Another kind of leadership tends to have people who agree with you around the table so that you have a unified agenda. Can we say that Obama has a history of surrounding himself with people of different points of view?
Oh, sure. His Senate staff had various points of view on it. And still does. He has a couple of folks there who are more political, and who are basing his pulling their opinions toward the middle, and then but most of his staff is somewhat to the left, and he would have those two sides fight it out in front of him, and then he would go make his decision, and often his staff could not tell from what he would say in the meetings, where he was going to go on a particular vote, so to speak. He would go out and surprise some of them. He wouldn't tell them, this is what I'm going to do. He'd take all their opinions, mull it over for an evening or a couple of days, and then he would go take the vote.
This was in the state legislature?
No, this was the Senate, and not so much in the state legislature. You don't have a big staff of policymakers and sharp minds on a state Senate staff. This was mostly in the U.S. Senate.
All right. Now, here's a clip of John McCain. This is actually from his convention acceptance speech on he as a leader who has worked across the aisle in the Senate and on sharing credit.
Again and again, I've worked with members of both parties to fix problems that need to be fixed. That's how I will govern as president. I will reach out my hand to anyone to help me get this country moving again. My friends, instead of rejecting good ideas because we didn't think of them first, let's use the best ideas from both sides. Instead of fighting over who gets the credit, let's try sharing it.
All right. So, David Hawkins, do his actions match his words in this case?
I do think it's fair to say that they do. Yes, I remember when I heard those words, I was fortunate enough to be in the room when he gave that speech, and when I heard it, I thought that's the soundbite for the campaign. That's how he should go out and campaign in the fall, because that's his, to me, from having watched him, that is, and maybe this is too much sort of inside baseball as somebody who covers Congress, that's his best argument, that he does have that record of being, he's accomplishment driven. I think this goes back maybe to his time in the Navy or the military culture that he comes from. It's a problem solving culture. You are given an assignment, you got to figure out how to carry it out, and that seems to be the way McCain has run his Senate career. He's sees, he identifies things he wants to tackle, and he gets people of many different voices in the room, and he figures out the best way to tackle it. He, you know, to use a cliche, he breaks a lot of china along the way. He makes a lot of enemies along the way. They are brief enemies. It's the for listeners who are familiar with the words of Saul Alinsky, there's the old Saul Alinsky cliche that there are no permanent friends in politics, nor are there any permanent enemies. I would say that's John McCain's style. He's willing to yell at you and holler at you one day, whether you're a staffer or a lobbyist or another senator, and then cut a deal with you the next.
Funny that you mentioned Saul Alinsky. Rudy Giuliani keeps mentioning Saul Alinsky when he campaigns for McCain, saying that Obama is in the Saul Alinsky style, which is a way of calling him as a socialist. But this old politician doesn't, an activist, doesn't come up very much these days. But Rudy keeps bringing him up, and now you brought up Saul Alinsky. Also, David Hawkins, McCain wrote in his book called Worth Fighting For, quote, "As a politician, I am instinctive, often impulsive. I don't torture myself over decisions. I make them as quickly as I can, quicker than the other fellow if I can. Often my haste is a mistake, but I live with the consequences without complaint," unquote. Wow.
Wow, yeah, it's sort of, it's very much sort of the anti-politician that sort of propelled him 8 years ago and that resurrected his campaign for the Republican nomination last year, I think, it's not often you hear that kind of candor from somebody who's seeking the presidency. It's also the case, I think that's true, I think that accurately reflects his style, that he's willing to undo a decision and make a different one. He's not afraid of saying something he's done is boneheaded historically.
Right. In fact, there was a New York Times article this summer that said, Mr. McCain is known to sign off on big campaign decisions and then march off his own reservation.
Right. It's a great line. Yes, he will. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why the campaign, now that the campaign has been elevated, it's the national general election campaign, perhaps that is why it's coming across as sort of seamless and having too many storylines, too many different advertising approaches, that he's toggling, he's going on one reservation and then on to the next, and not just sticking with one.
Let's take some phone calls. People are calling in. Gregory in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Good.
I was a teenager in high school when I had seen one of those made-for-TV movies back in the 70s on John McCain's life, and principally covered his experience as POW. Hmm. And that was enough to motivate me to go into the Naval Academy.
Wow.
When I went there during our basic training, we were marched into an auditorium where John McCain, I don't believe he was a senator yet, it was 1981, was a speaker there, and I was left completely in awe of him. He's a very charismatic man, and knowing somebody on that level, even though it was brief, really makes me see how much the national image of anybody, I'm sure even George Bush is not the same man that you would know personally as what you would imagine him to be from his national image. And John McCain is no exception. He's a very charismatic individual, very inspirational, and he knows his style, and I believe he simply accepts his losses with his wins as just part of his method of operation. I'm just disappointed after his association of the Keating Five and the way it seems now, he seems to be floundering and just shooting from the hip desperately. He seems to be losing his composure. But the man he is more than, I think, a lot of what people think of him from his national image now.
Do you think, then, that he has really changed since McCain was such a formative inspiration for you? But it sounds like you're disappointed in him recently. You think he's changed from the John McCain who inspired you, or what?
No, I think that he's accepted that His style is his style, and he understands that when you're in the military and you're a military leader and officer, and he's been through a lot of people are aware of his experience as a POW, there was a, within the military at least, there was a very famous episode where there was a fire on a United States aircraft carrier where a missile that was attached to a plane exploded, and over 100 servicemen, I believe it was 120-something, 130-something servicemen were killed. He was the pilot who was sitting in the plane waiting for takeoff when that missile exploded and the fire started. It wasn't his fault, of course. But that happened to be caught on film, and it was used in training and still used to this day in training. And he himself said that affected him terribly. It made him think about... have second thoughts about using napalm in the war when he was, of course, a pilot in Vietnam. And the processes you have to go through as a leader, you just learn to accept a lot of the consequences of your decisions. Yeah. And when he says, you know, he doesn't think about the consequences once you make a decision, it's part of the nature of what his training and what he's been through that you
that's fascinating. That's a very military
to inhibit you.
A very military style of relating to your decisions and their consequences.
Absolutely.
Gregory, thank you very much. Fascinating.
You're very welcome, sir.
And Liz in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Liz.
Yes, thank you. I want to ask almost a question, propose another leadership experience that Barack Obama had, I believe. In the late 1990s, for several years, I think he was actually chairman of the board of the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, and I've heard so little about what the CAC was able to accomplish under his leadership with the many millions of dollars they were fortunate enough to be able to give to Chicago public schools.
Did you write that up, David Mendel, for your book on Obama?
Well, I didn't really use much on the Annenberg Challenge, but it was not very successful. It was a school reform movement here in Chicago, and the city really was resistant to change at that point. And it didn't. It hasn't been until the last few years that the school system here in Chicago has really been able to create a lot of new charter schools. It's a massive bureaucracy that movement was up against, and it wasn't very successful. But there was more than just Barack Obama in charge of that. There were a lot of leaders of the community, and that was just a very part-time role.
Did he have that title of president of that board?
He was the chairman for one of the years, I believe, of the board, but he was not the person who was supposed to go out and implement the program. He was the chairman of the foundation that was created.
Right, but nothing that you dug up in researching him or covering him in those days indicated a leadership or a management style or effectiveness in leadership.
Well, I mean, I think his most effective, if you want to point to something that he worked in the nonprofit world, was Project Vote, in which he that was his first real role after coming back to Chicago from Harvard, in which he worked in the African American community, and they enlisted about 150,000 people onto the voting rolls, mostly African American, and that was a challenge for him because he was overseeing a lot of volunteers. A lot of people weren't getting paid much, and it took a lot of massaging of people who, you know, were just committed to the cause, and it was successful in the end. It really helped elect Carol Moseley Braun to the U.S. Senate, and it helped Bill Clinton win Illinois in 1992.
All right. Well, there is so much more we could do, but we're going to go on to part three, which is a generational comparison of Obama's and McCain's leadership style. One is generation before Baby Boomer. One is a generation after Baby Boomer. And we'll see how that life experience at that time may have shaped Obama and McCain as a leader. But I want to thank both our guests, David Mendel, author of Obama From Promise to Power, which was just issued in paperback. He also blogs for Chicago Magazine and teaches at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. And David Hawkins, the managing editor of Congressional Quarterly Weekly, who has covered John McCain for many years. David, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 27, Their Leadership and Management Styles. We continue in a minute. WNYC, and you can see video clips from some of our recent interviews, including Mia Farrow in our studio talking about Darfur, Naomi Klein on the financial crisis, and Madeleine Albright on the Obama foreign policy. That and many more video clips from our show at wnyc.org/video. It's 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 27, Obama's and McCain's leadership styles and management styles. And for the first time in 16 years, there will not be a baby boomer in the White House. John McCain was 8 years old already when World War II ended. And as we all know, when Barack Obama was eight, Bill Ayers was wreaking havoc on the streets of Chicago. So he's younger than a baby boomer. When John McCain graduated from college, this song was on the radio.
Dream, 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 dream.
And when Barack Obama graduated, people were listening to this. So a big generation gap between Obama and McCain. Yes. All right. Yes, it was the Everly Brothers. That's right. And Michael Jackson. Yes, it was. Lisa Chamberlain, who wrote a book about Generation Xers called Slackonomics, Generation X in the Age of Creative Destruction, is here to talk about this generational issue. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back.
I love the musical lead in there.
what generations are John McCain and Barack Obama a part of? Can you put actual names on them? And how do you see them fitting into their generations?
Yeah, John McCain, he's part of what's known as the Silent Generation, which came kind of just briefly right after what Tom Brokaw called the Greatest Generation. So it's a smaller group of people, and the silent part had to do with the fact that they were sort of overshadowed by the Greatest Generation, which actually has something in common with Obama's as well, because the baby boomers were, you know, overshadowed Obama's generation. And he doesn't call himself Generation X, but he does call himself of the post-boomer generation. And I suspect that's because he probably doesn't want to be known as a slacker. So he's avoiding the whole Generation X label, which a lot of people don't really love.
Well, in your book, Slackonomics, you see Generation X as a group that didn't like doing homework, spent too much time on the computer, but then ultimately used their slacking for good. Some of them started innovative companies like Google and Facebook, which actually came out of their slacking around.
Right, exactly. Well, part of what I tried to do was couch the circumstances of the time in economics. And so Generation X, that is generally thought of as the slacker generation, you know, graduated from college and came of age at a time of economic insecurity. And so when they were graduating from college, their, you know, entry-level wages had been dropping. The whole corporate model was crumbling. And so what looked like a generation of slackers was really just sort of people who didn't have great economic opportunity. But once the economic opportunity came along, they certainly took advantage of it.
Why put your nose to the grindstone if there's no opportunity out there? So by that reckoning, we're in for a new generation of slackers as capitalism crumbles once again.
Yeah, well, it'll be very interesting. And one of the things that I found is people in their 20s are reacting pretty well to my book, and I think because they recognize a lot of many of the forces that were put into play when Generation X was coming of age are still very much in play, and if not, even exacerbated.
But Obama seems to have always been a striver who liked doing his homework, so maybe he doesn't fit perfectly into that pattern.
No, and neither does McCain, for that matter. The Silent Generation was thought to be pretty, you know, sort of toe the line, and, you know, they're called silent in the fact that they were not, you know, sort of rebellious or mavericky, as McCain is. So So in some, you know, you of course you can't chalk up their entire worldview to a generational analysis. But
right.
What I would say is that it's interesting that their leadership and their policy positions are definitely in line with the economic circumstances of their different generations. So McCain was born at a time that is considered one of the most economically beneficial in terms of realizing a lifetime of prosperity, whereas Obama grew up at a time of economic insecurity. And both of their positions, I think, reflect that.
Now, Obama defeated Hillary Clinton in part by using her boomerdom against her. She was fighting ideological battles in the 60s and then in the 90s against Newt Gingrich, et cetera, while he, Obama, portrays himself as past ideology, past the whole 60s thing, supposedly. John McCain beat Mitt Romney, another boomer, for the Republican nomination. Is it just a bad time to be a boomer politician? Do you think that
absolutely.
There is something about boomerness that, you know, let us wind up with nominees who are one from before, one from after?
Yeah, absolutely. And it both definitely came from a time of, you know, when ideology was not the prevailing sentiment. And so that is very appealing right now to voters, I think, because, you know, we're really sort of, there's a lot of boomer fatigue out there. Some of it, I think, can be attributed just to the fact that George Bush is a boomer and a lot of people are unhappy with his leadership. So it gets sort of stuck on baby boomers in general. But, you know, Obama, he wrote in his second book, I think, which is interesting, he said, "I sometimes felt as if I were watching the psychodrama of the baby boomer generation played out on the national stage." And I think people are feeling tired of that.
Yeah. Now, McCain's political life in some ways imitates the evolution of the boomer. Early in his political life, McCain defined himself by his rebellion. He bucked the party line on campaign finance. I mean, not really early in his political life, but at that phase that started around the 2000 presidential campaign and bucked the party line on campaign finance. 2001 voted against the Bush tax cuts. But recently he has conformed to a stricter Republican ideology.
That's turned out to be a mistake, apparently.
Well, good enough to get him the nomination, but a mistake enough not to get him elected. But he, or so it seems as we sit here today. But, you know, maybe that's kind of like the boomer pattern of early rebellion and then conforming.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. But on the other hand, it's the boomer, there's still an entrenchment in ideology with boomers, regardless of, you know, whether they ended up becoming strivers or not. I know that, you know, my mom is a baby boomer, and she still very, very much identifies as a liberal. But, you know, of course, she had her own business and made her own money. It didn't stop her from succeeding.
Right.
But politically, she is very much in one camp and always will be.
Rooted in her time.
Yeah.
Do you think, well, of course, technically, Obama is a boomer, right? If he's 47 years old, born in 1961, they say the boomer generation ended with those born after 64.
Right. There's some strange wiggle room in there. There's another sort of tiny little subgroup, sometimes called the Jones generation, that people think it sort of is sandwiched slightly in between the boomers and the Xers. And that doesn't resonate, I think, with nearly as many people. But Obama himself has identified as part of a post-boomer generation, and his worldview definitely reflects that.
Now, one of the stereotypes about Generation Xers is that they start work as an intern, but then immediately expect to rise. They want to be the CEO before they've put in their time. Is Obama's ambition, and we see how quickly he's moved his career along here, is that symptomatic of this?
Yeah, perhaps. I think that there may be something to that. I think another interesting thing about Obama is that he sort of backed into politics. I mean, Generation X is notorious for sort of not really embracing the political world, and in fact sort of disdaining it to some extent. And Obama, he had an idea that he wanted to sort of engage with the world and make things better, but that didn't translate automatically into going into politics. It took some time before he realized that that was the route.
Is there a
and
model?
That's very Generation X.
Is there a model of a Generation X CEO?
Well, definitely the Google guys. They're the easiest ones to point to in terms of.
And what is that in terms of management and leadership style?
Both in terms of, you know, fostering an innovative and creative environment. That's not to say that it's anarchy and people can do whatever they want, but that, you know, allowing people to be to work in, to sort of define their own work terms. So long as you're producing and being a, you know, a good sort of productive player, that's very much encouraged. And it's not just encouraged because we're nice guys. It's encouraged because it's shown to yield results.
And in our last 30 seconds, is there anything, any such thing as a silent generation leadership style?
You know, that I wouldn't be as clear on. And McCain, if there was, I'm not sure that McCain would reflect it anyway, because he doesn't, in terms of his personality, it's much more sort of driven by his, you know, as we have all come to know, his sort of mavericky style. And as David Brooks pointed out in a recent column, you know, Maverick is not really a guiding philosophy. It's more of a personality, more of a personality trait.
Lisa Chamberlain, author of Slackonomics, Generation X in the Age of Destruction. Really interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
And that's 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 27, Obama and McCain and Their Leadership Styles. So that's the general on leadership and management. Tomorrow we'll get more specific on this with Issue 28, Who Would Make the Better Commander-in-Chief? Brian Lehrer on WNYC.